Look around you right now. Like, if you're near a window, maybe you can see a steel suspension bridge in the distance. Or just the frame of a car parked outside.
Yeah, or even just the metal hinges on your door.
Exactly. And
yeah.
There is this overwhelming illusion of permanence to those objects. They look completely solid, static. It feels like once that metal tooled down in the factory, the story was over. The structure was just locked in forever.
It is a really convincing illusion. I mean, we perceive metal as dead matter. You hit it with a hammer, it clangs, it holds up skyscrapers. It really doesn't seem like it's doing anything internally.
But if you could zoom in way, way in, right, you would see that this rigid piece of steel is actually a frozen battlefield.
Oh, absolutely.
It's full of hidden architecture. Mm-hmm. Inside that solid beam, atoms are constantly shifting, warring with each other, and locking into place based on all these invisible forces around them. And well, today's deep dive is going right into the heart of that hidden battlefield.
It's a really wild place to explore.
It really is.
Yeah.
Now, normally, if you wanted to change the fundamental chemical structure of a material, you'd use a chemical reaction. Or, you know, you'd melt it down with intense heat.
Mm.
But what if you could change a metal's internal chemistry and its atomic growth just by squishing it incredibly hard?
Right, which sounds totally counterintuitive. It's almost like trying to bake a cake by hitting the batter with a baseball bat.
Yeah.
But that's exactly the core mystery we're looking at today.
We have our hands on a really fascinating piece of scientific detective work. It's a 1994 paper from the Journal of Material Science. And the title is Cementite Precipitation During Tempering of Martensite Under the Influence of an Externally Applied Stress.
Which is, I mean, undeniably dense.
Bit of a mouthful, yeah.
But the mission behind that title is brilliant. See, at the time this was published, scientists knew perfectly well the end results of heat-treating steel. They knew that when you heated certain steel up, microscopic carbon particles formed inside it, making the metal tougher. But the exact mechanism of how those internal crystals actually grew, specifically these particles called cementite, was a matter of intense debate.
Okay, let's unpack this. Our goal today is to uncover how these researchers designed an experiment to literally squeeze the answer out of a metal. We're going to look at how applying astronomical physical pressure to steel completely changes its microscopic crystalline structure, and how that extreme experiment solved a debate about how metals transform.
Yeah, it's a great story.
But before we get to the giant crushers, we really need to understand the starting point. Like, what is the baseline state of the metal before they start messing with it?
So the researchers started with a very specific custom batch of steel supplied by British Steel. It had 0.44% carbon and a remarkably high silicon content.
Wait, why add extra silicon? Does that change the strength or something?
No, it's actually a really clever experimental control. In normal steel, as it heats up, several different types of microscopic carbides can form, which totally muddies the waters if you're trying to observe one specific reaction.
Oh, I see. Too much noise in the day.
Exactly. So the silicon acts as an inhibitor. It actively prevents those other transitional carbides from forming, ensuring that the only thing growing in the steel is the cementite they actually wanted to study. It isolated the variable.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. So they have this custom high silicon steel. How do they prep it?
Well, to get it into the right starting state, they heated it up until the carbon completely dissolved into the iron, and then they shocked it.
Yeah.
They quenched it in an iced brine solution, followed immediately by plunging it into liquid nitrogen.
Whoa, liquid nitrogen flash freezing. That seems a bit extreme, just to cool something down.
It is extreme, but extreme cooling is the only way to guarantee a 100% conversion into a phase of steel called pure martensite.
Pure martensite, right.
Yeah, when you cool steel that fast, the carbon atoms literally do not have the time to diffuse or escape. They just get trapped inside the iron crystal lattice.
Uh-huh.
It forces the metal into an incredibly strained, unstable state.
So the liquid nitrogen ensures there are absolutely no soft spots left behind.
Right. You're left with pure martensite, which is exceptionally hard, but dangerously brittle.
Yeah. Looking at their measurements in the paper, the starting Vickers hardness of this liquid nitrogen quenched martensite was 722.
Which is massive.
Right. For those listening who don't work in metallurgy, a Vickers hardness over 700 means this steel is practically unyielding. Like a typical structural steel might sit around, I don't know, 150.
Give or take.
But because it's so heavily strained by all that trapped carbon, this pure martensite is almost like glass. If you hit it hard enough, it wouldn't bend. It would just shatter into a million pieces.
Which means it's totally useless for building bridges or cars.
Right.
So to make it useful, metallurgists do something called tempering. They heat the brittle metal back up to a moderate temperature. In this experiment, they heated it to 400 degrees Celsius.
And tempering is what allows that trapped carbon to finally move around, right? Because the paper notes that after heating it to 400 degrees, the hardness actually drops from 722 down to 587. Why does heating it make it softer?
Because the heat gives the carbon atoms the energy they need to escape their tiny microscopic prisons. As they leave the strained iron lattice, they congregate together to form these tiny hard particles, the cementite.
Got it.
And because the carbon has vacated the iron, the internal tension of the metal drops. The steel becomes less brittle, a bit softer, but much tougher overall.
And the way those cementite particles form naturally, like when you just heat the steel without doing anything else, is in a pattern called a Widmann-Stettin array.
Yes.
We actually have a microscopic image of this baseline state from the paper. A Widmann-Stettin array basically looks like a microscopic logjam. You have these tiny, needle-like carbide particles pointing in multiple different directions, crisscrossing over each other.
Yeah.
It's just total chaos.
Total chaos. And that chaos brings us to the core debate the researchers were trying to settle. Historically, many scientists believe these cementite particles grew through simple, random diffusion. Yeah, they thought the carbon atoms just wandered aimlessly through the heated metal until they bumped into each other and formed a lump.
So it's not like a synchronized thing. It's like people randomly milling around a crowded room until a few of them happen to bump shoulders and form a conversation circle.
Exactly. But there is a competing theory called the displacive transformation mechanism. This theory argued something much more coordinated. It proposed that the original crystal lattice of the iron doesn't just passively let carbon wander through it.
Okay.
The iron physically warps or deforms to force the space needed for the carbon to crystallize.
Yeah, the paper uses a phrase for that that really tripped me up. It describes this warping as an invariant plane strain with a large shear component, which sounds incredibly dense.
It is dense, but we can break it down. Imagine a brand new deck of playing cards sitting on a table.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
If you press your hand flat on the top of the deck and push forward, the cards slide over one another. The deck tilts. It changes shape from a rectangle into a leaning parallelogram.
Oh, yeah.
That tilting motion is shear. The individual cards didn't break. They just slid in a highly coordinated way.
Oh, I see. So the iron atoms aren't randomly wandering. Entire microscopic layers of the metal are physically sliding and tilting in a coordinated maneuver to create a very specific geometric pocket for the cementite to grow in.
That is the displacive theory in a nutshell. It's a macroscopic shape change happening on a microscopic atomic level.
What's fascinating here is that if this deck of cards shift is real-like, if the metal literally has to physically bulge and tilt to form a crystal, then a massive external physical force should be able to interfere with it.
Exactly, because if the microscopic pocket is trying to push outward in a certain direction, and you're on the outside of the metal pushing back in that exact same direction,
they block it.
You block it completely.
Yeah.
The hypothesis was that if the displacive theory is true, physically squeezing the metal from the outside while it's tempering should dictate which way those internal crystals are allowed to grow.
Which finally brings us to the experiment, the physical squeeze. They didn't just throw this steel into a standard oven. They used a computer-controlled thermomechanical simulator.
Right.
They took that pure brittle martensite, heated it to 400 degrees Celsius for 30 minutes, but they ran the test under three conditions.
Mm-hmm.
No stress, 500 megapascals of compressive stress, and a jaw-dropping 950 megapascals of compressive stress.
And they held that immense pressure constant for the entire 30-minute tempering process.
I have to pause on that number. 950 megapascals is one of those figures that's, like, easy to gloss over on a page, but in reality, it's terrifying.
Oh, it's massive.
That is roughly equivalent to the pressure at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, multiplied by nearly 10. It's almost 140,000 pounds per square inch.
Yeah, it's hard to even fathom.
Right. If we're squishing a small steel cylinder that hard, wouldn't it just pancake? I don't understand how they could look at microscopic carbon needles inside a piece of metal that has been subjected to the forces of a planetary core.
Well, the sample absolutely does deform under that much brute force, but it doesn't turn to dust. Remember, we started with liquid nitrogen-quenched martensite, which is one of the most unyielding states of metal we have.
Good point.
But you're highlighting the hardest part of the experiment. You can't just put a crushed, warped cylinder under a microscope and expect to see atomic structures. The surface is ruined. The preparation of the samples for observation is a masterful process all on its own.
Walk me through it. Because the paper says they cut thin slices perpendicular to the direction of the applied stress.
Right. So you have a cylinder that's been pressed from the top and bottom. They slice it horizontally, like slicing a carrot. Then they take that slice and manually grind it down until it's paper thin. But mechanical grinding still leaves microscopic scratches that would obscure the view.
So they use acid?
Yes, a technique called twin jet electropolishing. They use a highly specific acid solution cooled to minus 10 degrees Celsius, and they apply an electrical current to dissolve the steel away atom by atom.
Atom by atom.
Literally, they polish the steel down to an incredibly thin 50 micrometers.
Oh, wow. For context, an average human hair is about 70 to 100 micrometers thick.
Yeah, they polish it until it's literally translucent to certain types of radiation.
And they need it that thin because they're using a transmission electron microscope, or a TEM.
Correct. A standard optical microscope just bounces light off the surface. It can't resolve individual crystallographic variants inside a solid. A TEM shoots a high voltage beam of electrons completely through the sample.
Right, through the solid metal.
Exactly. The electrons pass through the empty spaces in the atomic lattice, but get blocked by denser atomic structures. The microscope basically captures the shadows of the atoms on the other side.
It's mind-blowing. They subject this metal to the most violent, high-pressure environment imaginable, and then use the most delicate microscopic surgical techniques to read the aftermath. And the visual difference they found when they finally shot those electrons through the sample was just stark.
It was night and day. We talked about the baseline earlier. Under zero applied stress, the TEM revealed the classic Widmanstetten array. The cementite needles were pointing in two or three different directions. The chaotic logjam.
But then we look at the image from the sample, tempered under the massive 950 megapascal stress. This raises an important question, because it's dramatically different. The vast majority of the martensite plates revealed only a single variant of carbide. The multiple directions, the chaotic crisscrossing, it was entirely gone. Every single particle was highly aligned, pointing in the exact same direction.
Yeah, and the 500 megapascal sample showed a very similar, though slightly weaker, alignment. The external pressure had systematically erased the other variants.
Here's where it gets really interesting. I keep imagining a crowded elevator. Like, imagine you have a dozen people in an elevator. If there is no stress, people are standing comfortably, facing a few different directions. Some are looking at the door, some are looking at the back wall. Maybe one is facing the side mirror. A microscopic jumble. That's your zero stress Widmanstetten array.
I like this analogy.
But if the elevator walls suddenly physically squeeze inward from two sides with incredible force, that's your 950 megapascals, suddenly every single person in that elevator is forced to turn and face the exact same direction just to fit their shoulders in. The external pressure physically removes all other directional options.
The elevator works because it captures the spatial reality of the displacive theory perfectly. The formation of each cementite variant requires the iron lattice to shift in a specific direction, our deck of cards tilting.
Right.
If the massive 950 megapascal external stress is pushing heavily against the direction the cards want to tilt, that variant simply cannot form. Only the variant whose shape change aligns perfectly with the external pressure, the people whose shoulders fit the narrowing elevator, is allowed to grow.
Okay, the visual makes perfect sense intuitively. But metal isn't a group of people making a conscious choice to turn their shoulders. It's a rigid thermodynamic system. How does sheer physical squishing actually rewrite the chemical rules of the metal? Like, how does a physical push stop a chemical reaction?
That is where the authors bring out the thermodynamic calculations, which is really the undeniable proof of their experiment. They explain that there's a massive tug of war happening with two competing forces at play.
Okay.
First, you have the chemical driving force. This is the natural thermodynamic desire of the supersaturated steel to purge the excess carbon as it heats up. The steel has a chemical need to precipitate cementite to reach a stable state.
And the second force is the mechanical driving force, the hydraulic press in the simulator.
Yeah.
But, I mean, how do you equate a physical push to chemical desire? They're two totally different things.
They seem different, but in thermodynamics, energy is energy. The authors calculate the mechanical driving force using something called the Patel and Cohen model. This model mathematically calculates how much energetic work is done by the applied stress interacting with the physical strain of the growing crystal.
Okay, what do the math say?
They found that for the 500 megapascal sample, the mechanical force generated about 730 joules per mole of energy. And for the 950 megapascal sample, it generated an impressive 1380 joules per mole.
Joules per mole. Help me visualize what that means in this context.
Think of joules per mole as the microscopic currency of energy. Every chemical reaction costs a certain amount of currency to happen. The paper notes that the basic chemical driving force, the metal's natural desire to purge the carbon, has a specific currency value. The key insight is that 1380 joules per mole is actually comparable in magnitude to the chemical driving force.
Ah, so the physical squeeze isn't just a gentle nudge. It's generating an amount of energy that rivals the chemical energy of the reaction itself. It's a massive thermodynamic thumb on the scale.
Yes, exactly. The external stress strongly favors the one specific carbide variant that naturally tilts in the same direction as the macroscopic squeeze. The energy of the squeeze assists that specific variant.
And the other ones.
Meanwhile, the other variants, the ones trying to tilt against the pressure, suddenly find themselves bankrupt. They simply do not have the thermodynamic energy, the currency, to fight back against 950 megapascals of external pressure. So they don't form at all. The physics literally forbids them.
Wow. That elegantly, definitively proves the displacive transformation mechanism. If the carbon atoms were just randomly wandering around and bumping into each other like the old diffusion theory suggested, external stress wouldn't force them into a single, perfectly aligned direction.
No, it wouldn't.
The fact that the physical stress directly controls the chemical variant proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that the formation involves a coordinated physical deformation of the metal lattice.
It was a huge triumphant moment for the researchers. They used brute force to prove a microscopic dance.
But, you know, proving a theory inside a multi-million-dollar computer-controlled simulator is one thing. Does this extreme elevator squish experiment actually explain anything that happens in steel naturally? Are there real-world implications, or is this just a neat laboratory parlor trick?
Oh, it's definitely not a parlor trick. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the authors make a point to tie this back to a very real, very mysterious metallurgical phenomenon. They link their findings to another form of steel structure called lower bainite.
What is lower bainite, and how is it different from the martensite we've been talking about?
Low bainite is a microstructure that forms at slightly higher temperatures than martensite does. And for decades, the mystery with natural lower bainite was that it almost always contains only a single crystallographic variant of carbide.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Without any hydraulic presses, without any scientists squeezing it, natural lower bainite looks highly aligned, just like the martensite did when it was being crushed at 950 megapascals.
Why would it do that naturally if no one is applying astronomical pressure to it?
It goes right back to the thermodynamic tug of war we just broke down. Remember, lower bainite forms at a higher temperature. Because the metal is hotter, it isn't cooling as desperately. Therefore, the chemical driving force, that natural frantic desire to purge carbon, is significantly lower.
So the chemical drive is weak. The thermodynamic currency is low.
Precisely. And because the chemical driving force is naturally so weak, it doesn't take 950 megapascals to overpower it. As metal transforms and shifts shape, it naturally creates tiny microscopic internal stresses against itself.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Right. In lower bainite, because the chemical drive is so weak, those natural subtle internal stresses are enough to entirely dominate the reaction.
So what does this all mean? It's a beautiful symmetry? The reason natural lower bainite almost always contains only a single carbide variant is exactly the same reason the highly stressed martensite did.
Yes.
In the artificial experiment, the researchers proved the mechanism by making the mechanical drive artificially massive. They cranked it to 950 megapascals to overwhelm the strong chemical drive. But in natural lower bainite, the same alignment happens simply because the chemical drive is naturally very weak. In both cases, the mechanical forces win the tug of war, and physics dictates that only the path of least resistance can survive.
The authors state it clearly at the end of the paper. The characteristic single-variant alignment of lower bainite is a direct result of internal stresses acting on a displacive transformation. They used a laboratory extreme to decode a subtle, everyday natural occurrence.
It's just strange to look at a steel beam now and realize what is actually going on inside. You think of a bridge or a car frame as solid mass. But underneath it all, it is basically frozen in a microscopic state of high-stress survival. By applying near-unfathomable pressure, these researchers proved that those internal crystals physically warp the metal to form. They validated a major theory by literally squeezing chaotic atoms into perfect singular alignment.
It fundamentally changes how you view solid matter, and it leaves me with a thought that goes far beyond just industrial metallurgy.
What's that?
Well, if external mechanical stress can so completely dictate the internal chemical and crystal alignment of something as notoriously rigid as steel, what does that mean for the natural world?
Where else would we see this?
Think about geological formations. Deep within the Earth's crust, rocks and minerals are enduring unbelievable tectonic pressures. Or think about the synthetic materials we rely on in extreme environments, like the titanium hulls of deep-sea submarines navigating the Marianas Trench, or the alloys used in structural components on space stations enduring radical thermal expansion and contraction.
Right, the pressure there is insane.
If immense pressure dictates atomic architecture, what invisible, entirely new microscopic structures are being forced into existence right now simply because of the extreme physical pressures of their environment?
Wow. We might be relying on materials that have completely rearranged their internal architecture just to survive the environment we put them in. The hidden architecture is always adapting, and we're usually none the wiser.
That is a wild thought to leave on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. The next time you walk across a steel bridge or just open a metal door, take a second to appreciate that it isn't just dead matter. There is a high-pressure atomic dance frozen in time right beneath your fingertips, an architecture built not just by chemistry, but by the sheer brute force of physics. Keep exploring, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.